DMR rifles, neck turning, drag bags, and more this week on Mail Call Mondays. I'm John McQuay with 8541 Tactical, and this is Mail Call Mondays, the show that answers your questions about precision rifles, optics, and equipment. Welcome to another Mail Call Mondays, and this Monday, our first question comes from Todd, and Todd asks, what do you recommend for the top DMR rifles? Well, Todd, there are a couple of different categories, I would say, of DMR rifles. There are DMR rifles for competition, for DMR-type matches, and then there are DMR rifles for actual use on the street in a law enforcement application. And you really didn't specify which one, so I'm going to try to touch on both of them. Now, for a rifle that I would use rolling into a regular DMR rifle competition, assuming that they don't have any caliber restrictions, would be this rifle in front of me. This is the 6.5 Creedmoor Mauten project that we completed quite a while back, and this continues to be my favorite semi-automatic competition rifle. The reason being is, first of all, it is a very reliable system now that we have the gas system dialed in, and you'll remember a while back we had some issues because we were using a standard 308 bolt carrier group, and I will tell you, this is a standard SR25/DPMS pattern system. So it accepts PMAGs, it accepts DPMS style barrel extensions and bolt carrier groups. So we had a standard 308 bolt carrier group in it. And the problem with those groups is they have too large of a hole in the bolt for the firing pin, and it allows excessive pressure to blow pieces of the primer cup back into the bolt. And that causes all kinds of problems with the firing pin and the bolt. So once we got that worked out and actually got the proper size firing pin hole in the bolt, this gun has been very reliable. It has been very accurate. It has a Criterion 24-inch barrel on it, and this is a medium-weight barrel. It's heavy for ARs, but it's not heavy for a competition rifle. Overall, the package does weigh a little bit more than your standard competition rifle, but that weight actually works to an advantage to resist recoil. It is a large overall package because it does have the 24-inch barrel, and then it has a brake on the end of that, and we are running a fixed stock on it because I don't see any reason that a collapsible stock would benefit you in a match environment. It is nice because we do have the 20-round magazine. I could go up to 25 rounds if I wish. And then, of course, there are magazine extensions that you can put on top of that. So you have a lot of options, but I usually just run a standard 20-round PMAG. There are quite a few other options. There are metal magazines out there, but the PMAG seem to work for me with the cartridge overall length that we are running on the 6.5 Creedmoor rounds. Now, if you were running in a tactical division or a cartridge limited division, this same rifle, but running a 20-inch or 24-inch 308 barrel on it, I think would do great as well. Overall, it gives me, I've got Keymod rails on here. If I had to do it again, I would probably go with M-Lock because M-Lock seems to be the standard. It seems to be what everybody is making new accessories for. So I probably would have gone with the M-Lock system, but it gives me the ability to put rails where I need them. Like I have a rail up here if I need to clamp on a camera system. I have a flush cup on the other side, and I have a flush cup adapter on the back of this PRS so I can run my sling on it, no problem at all. Have a rail up front here for the Atlas bipod, and back here I actually have a barricade stop that I've been trying out. I'll remove the bipod and just run the barricade stop against here, and it gives me a nice hard stop forward of the bell of the scope. That way, if I have a smaller port that I can't actually fit the objective bell through, I can run the barricade stop into it and not have to worry about putting excess stress on the scope or hammering the scope with that barricade. I also have a rail back here to take care of the brass catcher, and the brass catcher, when it is snapped on this rail, prevents me from running the rifle far enough through a barricade to get on the magazine well back here. So that's the other purpose of the barricade stop up here. I also have a Really Right Stuff Arca Swiss style adapter here. So that allows me to drop it on the Really Right Stuff tripod and lock it right into that head very quickly if I need to do that. So overall, this setup works very well for competition. However, if we switch over and we look at that law enforcement role, this is really overkill for the law enforcement role. This is a 1,000-yard plus capable rifle. It is designed specifically for competition, the way I have the barricade stops set up and the tripod mount and the brass catcher and all that. There really is no need for a lot of that stuff in a field environment the law enforcement officer is going to see. Now, my rifle that I use for a DMR capacity on the law enforcement side of things, the back half is pretty similar. It runs on actually an Armalite setup, so it utilizes Armalite pattern magazines and bolt carrier group. But it runs a 16-inch lightweight barrel because I really don't need the added velocity that the longer barrel is going to give me, and I really need a more compact package that I can get in and out of vehicles, that I can move around barricades, that I can get in and out of structures with. So a more compact overall rifle is really necessary, and you'll find that in most urban environments, you don't need that added barrel length because you don't need the added standoff range that it gives you. A 16-inch 308 is still capable of 500, 600, 700 yards. You can stretch a 16-inch 308 out to 1,000 yards with the correct ammunition choice, but that is well beyond what is going to be reasonable in a law enforcement environment. So I have a 16-inch lightweight barrel. Additionally, a DMR rifle is not necessarily a sniper rifle. That level of precision is a little bit different in the DMR rifle. So the lightweight barrel still allows me about a 1 minute angle group at 100 yards. 1 minute angle is really sufficient to handle any problems that you're going to run into in a law enforcement situation. You could still take a hostage shot if you needed to. I can still reach out, and if the conditions are right, I can still take a 300-yard headshot if I needed to. So a 1 minute angle rifle is perfectly able to do it, and the Faxon 16-inch barrel that I have on that rifle is capable of the accuracy level that I need, and it doesn't give me the weight penalty. I still run a fixed stock on it, although I probably will be changing over to an adjustable stock on that rifle because I wear different levels of body armor depending upon the different situations. So if it is just a really quick thing that's going down, or it's a I might need a rifle or might not need a rifle, then I may grab the rifle and just have my soft armor on. If it is a more severe situation or we are taking fire, then I will probably put a plate carrier on, which runs thicker plates. I may run into a situation where I need a shorter length of pull. An adjustable stock allows me just to collapse that stock a couple of notches to account for the plate carrier and still maintain good eye relief and not have to be straining my neck to get into the appropriate position. We flip over to caliber again. My DMR rifle for law enforcement purposes is .308. The ammunition is mandated by the department. I don't have any say on that. So it has to be .308, and the barrel twist has to be capable of shooting the ammunition that they issue. So that is kind of locked in, whereas for competition, I prefer to go with a little bit better performing round. For the law enforcement side of it, the .308 is perfectly capable of getting done what I need to get done. And there's also a very wide variety of ammunition choices on the .308 side. Now, the difference between the DPMS pattern and the Armalite pattern is very small once you actually get the rifle together. However, anybody that is building a rifle now, I recommend going with the DPMS pattern. That really is kind of what the industry is standardized on. There are more bolt carrier groups available. Most aftermarket barrels are they have the barrel extension set up for the DPMS pattern. So that is really what I recommend. Now, be very careful if you are building up a rifle for competition, because the various different local matches have different rules as far as their DMR rifles. Some of the ones that I've shot are fairly open. Basically, it just has to be a gas gun. And then from there on, the rules are open on whatever you want to equip it with, whatever cartridge, etc. Some of them some see the DMR class as more of a tactical or law enforcement type class. So they will want you to run a 223 or 308, something that is a standardized military caliber. So make sure you check the rules before you build out the rifle. But one of the great advantages of the AR platform is you can build a couple of different upper receivers, use a quick release, or use an easily dismountable scope setup. So if you need to swap things over, say you're going to a match that only allows 308 and your rifle is a 6.5, well, you could have another upper assembly. And if you went even so far as to utilize something like a Fortis Switch forend rail, I could have this whole forend set up exactly the way I want. And if I need to swap an upper assembly, then I can just flip the lever, pull the rail off, grab the other upper receiver barrel gas block in that is already assembled, slide the rail back on, lock it down, put my bolt carrier group in, and roll. And that will really reduce the added expense and give you that switch barrel capability in a standard AR type upper without any extra bells and whistles. So that's just kind of some tips, some thoughts that I have on a DMR rifle setup. Now you'll notice that I didn't mention the M1A or M14, and there's a reason for that. Much like we discussed in our last Mail Call Mondays episode, you can get a whole lot more for a whole lot less going with a large frame AR than you can going with an M1A type setup. If you go with that, there are some more restrictions as far as barrels. It's a little bit harder to get them to perform very well and very consistently. Sometimes they can be made to perform very reliably, but the accuracy consistency is there or not, depending upon the day. Also, one thing that I didn't mention in the last episode is scope mounts are a lot more difficult with the M1A pattern. You can run into issues with the scope mounts coming loose, and obviously that affects your accuracy very quickly. So if you are building one up specifically for competition or for the law enforcement role, I recommend the AR platform. Even in our DMR rifles for the department, we have some M14s, and there are a lot less problems with the AR patterns than there are with the M14s. So that's just my opinion on that. I know sometimes that hurts some feelings because the M14 and the M1A has a cult following. They are classic rifles. They're absolutely amazing battle rifles, but they never were really intended to be precision rifles or sniper rifles. So just keep that in mind. So overall, I hope that answered some of your questions, and I hope that gives you some insight. And if you have any more follow-up questions, please drop them in the comment section down below. I tried to cover both the competition side and the professional side, so hopefully somewhere in there I gave you something you can use. And our next question is from Funkel, and he asks, is it worth neck-turning brass for PRS-style competitions? If so, what type of neck turner do you recommend? What neck dimensions do you recommend for the 6.5 Creedmoor? Well, I've played with a couple of different neck turners just to see if I noticed any difference. And I have a neck turning setup, and maybe at some point we'll go over the details on it. I believe the one that I have is an RCBS. But I had it to be able to solve problems when we're setting up brass and match chambers for some of the other rifles. I don't really go for something that requires neck turning. Specifically, I was talking to my gunsmith about building up a new rifle, and one of the concerns I had is that the reamer that he's using, I wanted to make sure that it was a no-turn reamer. There are some reamers, some chamber designs out there where they require you to turn the neck because they are very close tolerances, and some brass may not actually work in that chamber without turning the neck down. I don't really want to mess with that because almost every match I go to, I will lose a piece or two of brass. Some matches, like if you go down to core and you shoot the rocks, you may lose a lot of brass on the rocks. I mean, you just can't go through there and pick up rocks to get down underneath it and to get your brass. These are big boulders. There are big gaps between them, and the brass bounces down underneath. That's why I like shooting gas guns with brass catchers, because I don't have to worry about that. And with the brass catcher, I walk off with almost 100% of my brass. But for that reason, I try to, make the brass prep as easy as possible. Now, I do realize that neck turning is a single time process. You only have to turn necks on your brass really once for the life of that brass. So it's not like every time you load your brass, you're turning the necks. You turn it once, forget about it after that. But it means when you buy more brass and you have to replace those cases, you do have to turn the new necks. So for me, it's just, I don't see it as a necessary step. The accuracy requirements for PRS style competitions, I don't feel warrant neck turning. Now, bench rest is a totally different animal. If you're a bench rest shooter, then you may need to turn necks to be able to maintain that level of accuracy that's required by that competition. But that's my opinion. I really want to know what you guys think, though. Do you think that brass turning is worth it for a PRS competition? Do you really mind the extra step in turning necks? And what are you guys using to turn your necks if you do? So please drop that in the comment section down below. Next, Steve asks, "Hi John, have a couple of questions about cases for transporting your match rifles. What brand do you use? Can you secure two rifles in it? And also, will it hold rifles with 26-inch barrels, chassis, and non-folding stocks? Really enjoy all of the shows." Well, Steve, the main case that I use right now when I'm going to and from the range, or if I'm going to a match, is the Precision Rifle Carry Case from Triad Tactical. And we'll drop a link down below for you guys to check out the review video that we did on them, and also so you can check out Triad Tactical's website if you want to pick one up. The Precision Rifle Carry Case really is a well-designed case. It's taken all the features that you see on a lot of the drag bags that are never really actually drug on stocks, and they removed all the extra features that you don't need if you're not dragging a bag. Things like that nose cap and the drag handle at the front and all this stuff. They got rid of all that, slimmed the bag down, and really, though, kept a really high quality, a really usable bag. They additionally have a feature where you can put shoulder straps on it if you're going to need to carry it as a backpack, and they do sell those straps additionally. So if you need the feature, you can purchase the straps and use them. You can take them off and put them in one of the pockets when they're not in use, or you can leave those off completely if you're not actually ever going to throw it on your back and carry it like a backpack. It's a really nice case. I've beaten it up over a couple of years and not had any problems with it at all. Haven't had any holes develop in it. Uses really high quality materials, and it's made here in the U.S. So I definitely recommend the Precision Rifle Carry Case. And Triad Tactical's not sponsoring this video. They're not paying us. All they did was they sent us one of the cases to do the review video a couple of years ago, and we've still been kicking it around and using it ever since. They do have a couple of different sizes. They've got a small size and a longer size. I believe the longer size may accommodate a 26-inch rifle without a folding stock, but definitely measure your individual rig and then look at the measurements that they have on their site. Now, the drawback is where a lot of the drag bags have a divider in it and they allow you to carry two guns in one bag, the Precision Rifle Carry Case does not allow for that. There's no divider in it, so it is really pretty much a single gun case. If you want to carry two guns, then get two cases. In my opinion, having used cases that carry two guns, it just gets incredibly heavy when you put two precision rifles into one case. It becomes a huge pain carrying them around. And then, for instance, one of the other cases that we use, Condor Drag Bag, which is actually the first rifle case I got when I got back into precision rifle shooting, that has kind of a flimsy internal divider, and you're never actually sure if that divider is going to stay there or if it's going to work its way down. I have still used it on occasion for throwing two rifles in there, but it's really not my preferred case to use. Also, the materials on that Condor bag have really suffered over time. I've blown out a couple of zippers on the pockets. I've worn holes through the external pockets. But the advantage there is it is low cost. It will hold a 26-inch rifle. So it's, overall, you get what you pay for. The reason that I got it is because it was an inexpensive Very close version of the drag bag that I used in the Marine Corps. And I did actually need a drag bag at the time because I was going to a school where I was going to have to stalk. And it did survive quite a few stalks being drugged behind me while I was crawling in a ghillie suit. So I will give it that. But again, the test of time, it has just not passed. It has fallen apart, blown zippers out, and it's not worth getting it fixed at this point. It just needs to be thrown away. But if you're not going to abuse it, if you were just going to use it for gently carrying your stuff back and forth to the range, and you really do need two rifle capacity, then that is an option. I believe Eagle discontinued the original drag bag that was based on, but there are a ton of copies that are out there currently. And again, we'll leave a copy to that or a link to that Condor copy down in the bar below. Now, if I am actually flying to a match, to me, a Pelican case is the only way to go. I have had rifles absolutely abused by baggage carriers in Pelican cases and come out on the other end perfectly zeroed with absolutely no damage whatsoever. The case now looks like hell. It's all rashed up. There are edges ground off of it. I slap stickers all over it and paint my phone number and big numbers on it. So it's seen some pretty hard use. But Pelican cases are great. They have a really great warranty on them. The drawback to them is they are heavy. And even though it's got wheels on the bottom of it, it is still just a pain in the butt to drag that around through the airport terminal. I've gotten a habit of always flying with bungee cords so I can lash my stuff to the outside of the case and use the case like a wheeled dolly to pull everything around. But you get tired of that really quickly. So for regular range trips, I don't use hard cases. They're just a huge pain in the butt, and I don't want to mess with them at all. But if I'm flying, for me, the Pelican case is the best option right now. I haven't found anything else that rises to that same level of durability. So I hope that gives you some options to look for. Again, I'll leave links to everything that I talked about down in the comments section down below or down in the description down below. And my brain's all over everywhere today. So I hope that helps you out. And our final question today comes from Joel. And Joel asks, do you think you'll be targeted by YouTube's takedown of firearms-related pages? Well, Joel, obviously, I can't tell what YouTube's going to do. For content creators on YouTube for a while, it's been a moving target to try to figure out what YouTube wants, how their algorithms work, and how they promote videos. They tend to change it to prevent illegal gaming of the system. But for those of us that are legitimate content creators, sometimes it can be a very difficult issue for us to stay on top of things. Now, do I feel that I'm going to be targeted? No, at this point, I really don't. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, you notice that most of the time we stay away from political topics. Politics can be a very personal thing, and it can be a very heated thing. And a lot of times when you start talking politics, people are not using the logical side of their brains. I've always tried to keep this channel a factual channel. I've tried to keep a lot of my personal opinion out of things, and I've tried to present things to you in your best interest. So I think the fact that we have done that and we have left a lot of politics out of it, you don't see me posting videos after any tragedies, commenting on them. And so that doesn't really give anybody a thing to focus on and to focus their rage on, because I can guarantee you if one of our videos got posted on one of the anti-gun sites, then very quickly I would have my hands full deleting comments, cleaning things up, trying to square away community strikes and all kinds of nonsense. A lot of the gun channels that have gotten taken down, those were apparently the result of YouTube bringing on new personnel to try to deal with some of the not advertiser-friendly content and poor training and poor guidance on the part of the new employees. And they were giving community guideline strikes to gun channels that really did not warrant them. For those of you that are not familiar with the way YouTube system works, if you receive or if you post content that YouTube does not believe is in line with their community guidelines, you will receive a strike. The video will get a strike. The video will no longer be viewable and your channel gets a strike. Now, the strike will fall off after a certain amount of time, depending upon how many strikes you have, and then you're free and clear again. If you get a certain number of strikes, then you are prevented from posting any new content until the strikes fall off. And if you get 3 strikes, then they automatically delete your account, delete all your videos. Everything goes away like it never existed. And you get no warning on that third strike. They figure the first and second strike was your warning. When they give you the third strike, your channel goes away. And that has happened to a couple of gun channels in the past. There are a couple of other gun channels, Military Arms Channel, Hank Strange's channel. They received a couple of strikes, and they received strikes either on content that was very old or received strikes that in no way, shape, or form violated YouTube's guidelines. And when you receive a strike, there is an appeal process, but very often it's difficult to get a hold of somebody at YouTube to actually go through the process, and it can take a while for your strikes to be reviewed and get revoked. Now, I'm speaking on this from a secondhand perspective because thankfully we have not received any community guideline strikes. I intentionally try to keep this show family friendly, and not because I'm worried about YouTube strikes. I try to keep it family friendly out of respect to you guys. I want you to be able to play our show in your living room, on your TV, with your kids running around. I want to be able to involve your children. I want to be able to involve your spouse. I want to be able to involve anybody that you want to direct our videos to without worrying about me saying something that is off color or offensive. Now, you know, there's no way that I'm going to be able to phrase this to please everybody. So if there's somebody out there that is offended by everything, obviously they're going to be offended by what I say, and I have no desire to change what I say based upon that. But I try to frame the show in a manner that if I was standing in front of your church group, I could still provide the exact same content that I normally provide without having to alter it. So again, I try to keep my language as clean as possible. I try to keep our content on track and on point. And I think that has helped me avoid a lot of the stuff that some of the other more activist-related gun channels receive. Now, just so you guys are absolutely clear, in this episode I talked about being a law enforcement officer. I am absolutely 100% on board with the individual right to possess arms and for every law-abiding citizen's right to carry arms for personal protection and personal defense. That's my personal belief, regardless of law enforcement, military background, all that. I believe you have the right to defend yourself, that it is not law enforcement's responsibility to protect you. You are responsible for your own safety. That is a core belief that I have based all of my firearms instruction, all of my firearms career on, and my law enforcement and military career on. It is part of our Constitution, and that is my belief. There are a lot of guys out there that seem to believe that law enforcement is against them, and I'll tell you, at least in my area, 90% of law enforcement officers that you will run across are firm believers in the Second Amendment and firm believers that individuals have a right to possess firearms to defend themselves. We see a lot of good done by privately owned firearms by regular citizens. So that's my personal belief. That's where I stand on it, because I'm not out here screaming about it in every episode. I felt it necessary to make sure you guys understand that that is where my belief system lies. Now, because I'm not screaming about Second Amendment rights and politics and bills that are going through Congress and all this in every episode, I think that has allowed me to avoid a lot of the targeted hate from the anti-gun groups. So that's where we stand right now. I don't really want to belabor the point anymore again, because we do have a worldwide audience, and I can look at the metrics. I can see where we have people tuned in. We do have a lot tuned in from Australia. We have people that tune in from South Africa, from all over Europe. So I want to make sure that you guys understand where I stand on it, but also why I'm not always preaching political issues on the show. I would like to know what your opinion is, though. Go ahead and drop me a comment down below. Do you think or do you appreciate the fact that I don't go on about political issues, or do you wish that I would address political issues a little bit more often? I really want to hear what you guys have to say, so drop me a comment down below. And that is about all we have for this show. I want to thank you guys for your ongoing support of our channel. If you guys like the episode, please make sure you like, share, and subscribe. If you have a question about anything we've covered, or you have a question that you would like to see covered on future Mail Call Mondays, please leave them in the comments section below or send them to us on Facebook or Twitter. If you're listening on your favorite podcast app, you can send questions to us at 8541tactical@gmail.com. And until next time, get out and shoot.